accession number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 9. Now, so what happened to your job's as a sergeant, acting sergeant, sort of accounting for the medical stores, ordering them when they run short, sending them out when they're needed. These are dental stores, are they?
Yeah, they were dental stores. You see, the Dental Corps Depot was also a school. And it also had a working clinic in there. So the people who were working on the clinical side had patients and so forth during the trip. We trained dental hygienists, dental technicians, all in the same setup, you see.
Just as you'd been trained
That's right.
2 or 3 years before.
That's right.
So what happened? I mean, is there anything about this time, or is it just a quiet time?
It was a quiet time. It was hard work. I was learning. I was a newly promoted sergeant. I had to take my military courses.
Now tell me about them.
Well, within the military system, you have to take your education. Your trade courses are separate. You have to take education, but you also have to take promotion courses. You don't get promoted unless you've got all three. Your trade, your education, and your promotion course. Yeah, there was a promotion course to corporal. There was a promotion course from corporal to sergeant. And there was a promotion course from sergeant to warrant officer. These are the three main courses you take. And they run concurrently with whatever trade training you're doing, and you're getting your different courses in for your different jobs you do. So at this stage, to become substantive sergeant, I had to take the military what they call a CARTA course, which is drill, fieldcraft, ranges, rifle shooting, all the rest of it. It's a military course, and you go to a central training centre for that, and you take this course. The central training centre for us was, of course, the RAMC training depot, because we were part of the medical services. And you get all three services, the nursing corps, the medical corps, and the dental corps, all went to a central place. And now, you took your CARTA course.
Was there anything new in this, or is it much the same as what we already discussed? Because we did do quite a bit about your military training before. Was this revision, or was this new?
Well, this is new, because it takes you on, because you've got more responsibilities. You learn the basic thing, and then you go on, and this is more to the, shall we say, grooming you for leadership. This is the whole thing that a lot of people don't understand, that to be a senior NCO in the army is a very, very responsible job. And they groom you for this with these CARTA courses. There's many, many aspects of the course. It's not just stamping around a barrack square. There's also many sorts of other things.
What sort of things do you mean?
Well, for instance, you have to take man management, okay? The psychological side of running the army, to look after your men. You also have to do all your, how can you put it? Well, it's just general management training, you could say. Because you are a manager, after all. You're middle management when you become a sergeant. And as you progress through the senior ranks, you become a very, very important guy on the management structure. Because don't forget, it's not the officers that run the army. It's the senior NCOs. The officers are only supervisors. But the guys that actually do the jobs and actually run the army, get the stores, look after the men, ta-ra-ta-ra, this is the senior NCOs. Overseen or overlooked by a warrant officer.
And what would you say the role of officers is then?
Well, the role of the officer is guidance, I suppose. They're the face that the public sees of the army, the officers. Many civilians, if taught to a civilian, he doesn't know at all what a senior NCO does. He knows what an officer does because he's always unsure. Maybe I'll ask the colonel. Yeah, well, lovely. But his is more PR than it is actual running the show. The actual running of the show is done by the warrant officers and senior NCOs, supported by the junior staff.
Now, you were doing your promotion course at Sergeant at the Royal Army Corps training depot. What also at Aldershot?
Was it Crookham, It's just outside. It's all Aldershot Garrison.
Now, what happens next then? I presume you passed that course.
Yes, passed that course and was promoted to Sergeant. And I had to go to Beaconsfield to do my instructional technology, as they call it nowadays.
What was it called then?
I don't know, I can't remember. Get so used to it, my cadet service now is all IT, but you were taught how to be an instructor. It was an instructor's training course. And you went to the Army Education Corps Centre in Beaconsfield and took your instructional training to be an instructor. And
now, what's the essence of that? What do you need to be a good instructor? What were they training you to be as an instructor?
Well, they train you how to project, how to do lesson plans, how to pass over the information from one person to another, because there is a technique of doing that. And you study this for 4 weeks at Beaconsfield and then take a wee exam and pass out as an instructor. And I became a trade training instructor. I instructed dental clerk assistant.
Now, where at? When did you start that?
About the middle of 1964.
And we based at the same place. You're still based at
the Duke of Connaught's Road. Royal Army Dental Corps headquarters.
Right. Tell us about your time as an instructor. What do you remember of that?
Well, I've always thought that has been one of the most interesting jobs I did. Because you get the new people coming through and you taught them a basic trade. Now, the basic trade training was 6 weeks. So every 6 weeks you got a new class of people. And you went through the course again and taught them their basic training. And they got a basic training in dental clerk assistant class 3. So they are a dental nurse, a basic dental nurse. And then they go out into the field to all the different, posted out to the different dental centres. So every 6 weeks I got a new class of people.
Had the course changed much from the time you did it?
Not really, no. Basically it was the same. Of course, you get on because you progress. Technically, you progress. You get better standard of equipment, better drugs, etc., etc. But that's the only change. But the basic how to do chairside assistant, handling the patients, assisting the surgeon, etc., it's all basically the same.
What developments were there? I mean, were there any in that period that moved dentistry along that markedly? Or was?
Oh, yes. You started to get a better standard of equipment for the actual dental, the thing that you sit beside in the chair with all the fancy spouts and so forth. You've probably been at the dentist yourself. They improved considerably. They became much more streamlined, much more fast, because you got compressed air machines, which you never had before. The standard of dental equipment moved from the old Rathbone, which was a belt-driven effort, which was quite slow. And I mean, the vibration when it was doing somebody's teeth was horrendous. Most of the pain in your teeth is caused by the vibration in the handpieces and that, because the machine's too slow. With the modern machine, with the compressed air machines, it's such a high velocity that you don't feel the pain. You can set fire to the tooth, in actual fact. It's that fast. But you don't actually feel the pain because there's no vibration. So the standard of equipment improved in these years through the 60s. And I mean, today, it's science fiction.
And any new drugs or new techniques developed during the 60s?
While I was training. Well, the replacement teeth system improved considerably. The crown and bridge preparation, where you actually replace parts of the dentition with an artificial item, but it becomes part of the living dentition. All is this, you don't plant them in the gums or anything like that. That's all rhubarb. That's rubbish. But they are attached to the existing dentition, you see. And these are done as a specialised item, crown and bridge preparations. I mean, I've worked for some very clever surgeons over the years.
And they were becoming, these crowns and bridges were becoming ever more sophisticated.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful stuff. Very expensive, in actual fact. You've ever had to pay a dentist's bill. Yes, it's... we're talking big money. But the technicians, the people who make these things, are highly skilled people. It takes a long time to train them. And the materials they are using is very, very expensive. So therefore, your finished item, if you take the guy's work together with the materials he's using, you've got something which is quite expensive. But that was the sort of progression. And of course, surgical techniques have come on a great pace from the days that when in the First World War, when they made artificial plates to go to cover up the holes, if you like, in people's faces and so forth. That's begun. The maxillofacial surgery has gone on by leaps and bounds. I mean, I'm 10 years out of time, well, longer than that, from the dental service. But in my time in the dental service, in the 20 odd years I worked in the dental service, progression was absolutely amazing.
Now, so what happens next? You're now working as an instructor, a sergeant instructor.
That's right.
Well, you know, how things go? Mid-64 onwards.
Mid-64, I got married. I was an instructor then for 2 years.
Now, did what was married life like in the sense of, did they fit you up with married quarters and things?
Not to start with, you had to find your own, because married quarters were few and far between, because you worked on a point system. You got points for service, points for the number of children you had, and so on and so forth. So as a young married couple, we had to take potluck and find our own place, which we did. It was quite a horrendous cottage on the edge of Ash Ranges behind Aldershot, private hiring. And you got a certain allowance for this. And we eventually moved into quarters. We were in a private hiring for 2 years. And then we finally got a married quarter. Actually,
now, what were the married quarters like?
Very good. Council-type houses. You know, two bedrooms, two up, two down, council-type. And you paid a fixed rent for that.
Furnished?
Yes, furnished. Basic furniture. I mean, you had got a furniture pack. You had everything you needed to live there. But anything fancy, well, you had to buy yourself.
Were you allowed to decorate and things like that?
Yes. As long as you stayed within the guidelines that was laid down by the local Ministry of Public Wonders and Blunders.
And was there a handing over
problem
if you hadn't, you know, I mean...
Part of the quartermaster staff, part of the duties of the guys in the quartermaster stores, there was one of them designated to look after Murray Quarters, and he marched you in and marched you out of the Murray Quarter.
Now, so, married, working as an instructor, what's next?
We then were put up for posting.
What year?
That was 1967.
So you were there 3 years as an instructor, which is a fair tour.
Oh, yeah, good tour. We were put up for posting, and I was posted to Cyrenaica District, which was in Libya, to the city of Benghazi.
Now, who were you posted to?
35 Company RAMC, which was the garrison hospital, to the dental department.
And what were you going out as?
As the administrator of the dental department.
The administrator?
Yeah. It was only me. It was me, a technician and a surgeon. And we were the dental team. Benghazi Garrison.
You weren't only the administrator, you were in the team.
I was part of the team, yes. So I dabbled again in surgery, but this is when I started to learn big time hospital administration, you know.
Now, what? Tell me about hospital administration. You know, what are the key skills you're learning out there?
Well, it's basic administration, because you to administrate a hospital, it's patient control, documentation, all that sort of thing, and running of the department itself. You have locally enlisted civilians who work in the department and are part of your staff, you know. But you run the place. You have to supply it, you administer it, you do all the documentation, and it's all worked in the hospital system. So you work to a central documentation system within the hospital.
Now, how did you get on with the Libyans that were employed within the hospital?
They were nice people. They were very different.
In what way?
Being Arabs, they think very differently to us. I can't really put a label on it, really. And, of course, it was a bad time for the local people at that time. I mean, I left my family in UK to follow behind, and I didn't see them again for 18 months because the Arab-Israeli war started.
And what were the effects of that on everything, basically?
Everything, well, I mean, the whole system in Libya fell to pieces. I mean, King Idris lost his grip altogether, and that's when you've got our friend Gaddafi coming in, very strongly influenced by the Chinese. When we handed over the installation, when we were moving out, there were Chinese personnel there in their Matsi Tung suits and little caps. So he was obviously being motivated from outside and manipulated. And King Idris, shortly after we left, of course, King Idris died and Gaddafi took over. We left there in March, April 1968.
So you're only there best part of a year.
Yeah.
Now, had the Arab-Israeli war had any other effects that you note on the street, you know, and other things? We'll come to when you leave in the Chinese.
Well, the people were subdued in some ways. It was just something, you know, something in the atmosphere that you sense. You see, when the Arab-Israeli war started, it started quite abruptly when Moshe Dayan attacked Colonel Nasser and zapped his Air Force on the ground. Because Nasser had been saber-rattling and he was going to take over and he was going to invade Israel and all sorts of things. And of course, the Israeli beat them to it. And they did it by their air force going out to sea and coming in and zapping NASA's air force on the ground, so he never got the chance to bomb or anything. And, of course, then the Israeli army, which was very, very efficient, moved in and zapped. It was all over in about 10 days. But the aftermath was quite extensive.
Now, what was the aftermath?
Well, the aftermath was the fact that the local Arabs, because the shockwave went right along North Africa through all the Arabs as far as Tunisia. You had an anti European feeling. We couldn't move about freely. We were within the cantonments of the basic camps. I mean, Benghazi, for instance, had two basic camps. It had Diosta Barracks, which was the headquarters of Sinai Gadistic, which was actually in the city of Benghazi. And that was an old Italian fort. It was a fortification. And that was just completely shut down. There was nobody came in there at all. We just sat tight inside it. And the other barracks was Wavell Barracks, which was on the outside of the city, on the desert. Where we had a tank regiment, and we were completely barbed wired in and couldn't move about. And of course, up country, you had an airfield, and then that was about the sum total of the British installations there. And they were completely sealed off for best part of 9 months. And eventually, of course, the order came to withdraw, and we gradually withdrew.
Now, how was the withdrawal managed? Tell us a bit about more about these Chinese chaps, you know, if you see what I mean.
Well, the withdrawal.
This is before Gaddafi has taken over, but just before.
It was before Gaddafi took over, yes. These guys just sort of appeared. When we were tied up the installation, we took to pieces all the installation, right? We couldn't move anything out because we didn't have access to the port. There was a little bit of air access, so we basically were going to move out of there with our personal possessions and hand over almost everything to Libs. We were going to sell them the installation at a knockdown price. So that's what we did. We did inventories of everything, assembled it in central places, and gradually what families were left in Libya were shipped out.
Yours never got out.
Mine never got out there. But what families were there already were shipped out, and closed down the installation. And then a team of people from the Lib government came around and literally just signed for it. I mean, the Oster Barracks, the story goes, there was a wee Libyan in an ancient Italian army overcoat just came and scribbled his signature on a piece of paper. It was a very, very...
And did you actually see these Chinese yourself?
Oh, yes.
And what were they doing?
They were just walking around with the takeover team. They inspected everything and signed for it. And there was two of them that came to the hospital, because the hospital was in a compound, you see, in Wavell Barracks. So it was a whole installation. And they just arrived with a team, a Libyan representative, and there was these two Chinese. And we signed over. I do believe it went for £40,000, would you believe, the whole installation. That's what the Libyans paid for it. And it was complete with everything. And we just moved out. We got our trucks, and we moved down, and we were lifted out by the Royal Air Force. From Benina Airport.
Back to England?
No, to Malta. Because Malta was our supply base, you see, for the African mainland. And we were a week or 10 days or so in Malta whilst we were all sorted out and eventually transshipped back to UK.
Oh, so you sailed back?
No, we went by air.
Sorry, transshipped, yes. Fooled me there. Yeah. So what happens next then? I mean, that posting was presumably truncated by all this.
That's right. Well, I came back to good old Aldershot again. And I was assigned to BAOR.
Germany,
yeah. So the headquarters of Rheindahl and Garrison. Headquarters, United Kingdom Land Forces, BAOR. British Army of the Rhine.
And where was that at?
Rheindahlen.
Darling.
Rheindahlen. Rheindahlen. It's near Mönchengladbach.
And which part of the headquarters? To the hospital part, I presume? Or was it just...
To the medical directorate.
The dental section of that? Or just
number one dental group. They started doing practice management. So you got a group dental group headquarters, and you've got umpteen dental units out in the field.
And this is, what, 1968?
1968, yes.
Now, this is your first time in Germany, I think.
Yes, first time
so
in Germany.
So, what were your impressions of the setup there? I mean, you're an administrator now. You're acting as administrator. Still
yes.
Sergeant?
Yes, still sergeant, yeah.
So, what's your impressions?
It was very highly, highly motivated, BOR. The people was very, very friendly sort of atmosphere, because of course it was NATO headquarters. So you had the Americans, you had the Belgians, you had the Dutch, you had all sorts of people in there, you know. And it was like a city, except it's an army barracks, and there's absolutely everything goes on there, you know. It's, as I say, it is the biggest unit in BOR.
And what were your duties as an administrator there? Any change? I mean, you know.
Oh, it was just office work. It was just in the office.
So no no practice, not like in Libya there.
No practice at all. Just paperwork.
Did you find that dull, or were you happy with that?
Oh, I was quite happy. Eventually, I got my family back. That was very nice of them.
Was that a big? I mean, separation from your family for 18 months, was it?
Yeah.
How much of a strain did that put on your relationship with your wife, relationship with your kids, you know, just generally?
Well, it's always a strain. I mean, but my little boy, for instance, my son, he was 7 months old when I went to Benghazi, and he was nearly three. So, of course, he didn't know who I was. So I had to start all over again, building a relationship with my son, you know. My little girl knew who I was because she was a year older than him. But that was quite hard. We got a married quarter in Germany, and my wife flew out, and we started married life again. Just picked up where we left off, if you see what I mean. But from the children's point of view, it was a bit traumatic, I think.
So what happens next then? Anything while you're with number one dental group? Or is it, I mean, office duties are office duties, I presume.
That's right. We moved up country to Paderborn Garrison.
To where?
Paderborn. Which is way up towards the border of the old West German border. And
the number one dental group moved there.
Yes. And we set up shop there, and just life just went on, you know. It was quite boring, really. But the beauty of it is, being in that part of Germany, you've got a good road system, and we got to go out and see quite a lot of things about Germany, which is very good, because it's a very interesting country.
How did you get on with the Germans? I mean, even then, it was 20 years after the war or whatever, you know. I mean, but
there wasn't any acrimony, not really. You got the odd one, the older generation that didn't particularly like the Brits, and they made it perfectly plain, you know.
How?
Well, I mean, you'd be standing in a queue in the post office, for instance, and then you get shoulder pushed out of the way, you know. Just silly things. Silly things, really. But no, on the whole, the Germans, we have always had a very good relationship with the Germans.
So what's next?
I then came back.
When?
In 1971.
So another 3-year posting.
Yeah.
Were you happy with the educational arrangements for your kids?
Yes.
Tell us a bit about them.
Both my children started primary school in Germany. And they were very good, because the British Forces Education Service, they run a primary school system, they run a middle school system, and there is, of course, a secondary school, two secondary schools, which are boarding schools. But what happens mostly, once the children finish middle school, you send them to boarding school, as both mine went to boarding school eventually here in UK. The army give you good allowances for that sort of thing, and both of my children are very well educated. They both have degrees. And
did you miss them when they went away on boarding? You know.
Oh yeah, you do. Of course you do. I mean, it's your family, you know. But you get used to it, and you get the system working where you go and pick them up, and they come with you and have their holidays with you, and so on and so forth. But you do miss them, because you miss their day to day growing. And that's a little hard.